Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 7th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, the effects of climate change on species distributions, high-energy gamma emissions from the crab pulsar, and the case for an Anthropocene geological epoch. Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A new study this week suggests that the species that are most vulnerable to climate change are those that occupy small, localized ranges, and that local areas of relative climate stability have been essential refuges for small-ranged species in the past. Comparing modern species distributions to localized historical rates of climate variation, Brody Sandel and colleagues honed in on fragile relationships that have implications for conservation efforts as our climate continues to change. Sandel spoke with me about the study from his office in Denmark.
So there were two major objectives in the study, and the first was to introduce this idea of climate change velocity as a measure of paleoclimate stability, and then also, of course, to calculate it. And then the second objective was, once we had that measure of velocity, to figure out how velocity relates to patterns that we see in modern ecological patterns. So distributions of species, patterns of diversity, and that kind of thing. We wanted to do this study because, in general, historical effects on modern ecological patterns aren't particularly well understood, and people often talk about historical effects, but it's been quite difficult to measure exactly their magnitude relative to the effect of things like modern climate. So we wanted to be able to put those two things side by side and look at the relative importance of modern determinants and historical determinants. And then the other major advantage of this study is that we're entering an era of rapid climate change, and one way that you can get an understanding of what we should expect is to look at what has happened under previous climate change episodes. So we're looking at what's happened in the past to try to help understand what will happen in the future.
So your first objective is to calculate this climate change velocity. Now, that's a term that not everybody might be familiar with. Can you sort of just define what that is and how you calculated it?
Sure. So it was proposed back in 2009 in a paper by Scott Laurie and colleagues. And the idea is it's supposed to be a measure of climate stability or climate movement that takes into account local topographic variability. So intuitively, climate change velocity is, if you're standing at a point on the Earth's surface, climate is changing over you, and you can think of that climate as moving over you. For example, at one point, it might be 10 degrees C as the mean annual temperature, and 100 years later, it won't be 10 degrees C there anymore, but it might be 10 degrees C a kilometer away. That climate condition will have moved a certain distance. And you can take that distance that it moved and divide it by the time it took to move there, and that gives you a velocity measurement. And it has a really nice biological interpretation because it describes the minimum migration rate that a species would have to obtain to keep up with climate as it changes over it.
Can you give a few examples of locations that we might be familiar with that have either a high climate velocity or a low climate velocity?
Sure. There are two major factors that control the climate velocity at a point. That is the rate of change of, for example, temperature through time, and the local topographic variability. So topography is a really important predictor of velocity. And intuitively, you can see that because if you think of yourself standing on a mountain slope and you need to get to a place that's 1 degree cooler, it's relatively easy to do that. You just move up the mountain slope, and that could require only a very small movement. Whereas if you're in a really flat area and you need to get to somewhere that's 1 degree cooler, you might have to move a very large distance to get there. So one nice example of a place with really high velocity is Denmark, where I happen to be. So Denmark is very flat and had a large change in temperature between the last glacial maximum and now. So you find really high climate change velocities in Denmark, something like 100 meters per year in many areas in the country. And then our prime example of a place with really low velocity are the Andes Mountains, where you have extremely high topographic variability and fairly low variations in temperature between the climate cycles. So there you might find velocities 10 centimeters a year, approximately.
And so one of your main objectives was to determine the relationship between this climate change velocity and modern species distribution. So how would you set up a methodology to tackle that question?
So the first thing was putting together a bunch of data. So in order to calculate velocity, we needed reconstructions of paleoclimate. So we were able to get estimates of mean annual temperature from the last glacial maximum. And then we combined that with current estimates of mean annual temperature globally. And those two things together could give us our velocity map. And then the other aspect, of course, was looking at the species distribution data. So for that, we pulled together range maps for three different vertebrate groups. We looked at amphibians, mammals, and birds. And for each of them, we used data sets that include range maps for nearly all of the terrestrial species in those groups. So altogether, it totaled about 21,000 different species range maps. With our velocity data and then the species range maps in hand, we took the species range maps and calculated a bunch of overall group descriptors of the species, things like total species richness, mean range size, and then what we focused on in the paper, of course, is the proportion of species at a location that are small-ranged, or we call it in the paper endemic. And then it was essentially just a regression analysis looking at how velocity combined with a bunch of descriptions of modern climate can predict a variation in the patterns that we calculated for each group.
And so, for reference, when was the last glacial maximum?
21,000 years ago.
Okay, and so what were your results? What was this relationship between these species ranges and climate change velocity?
So the big result is that we see very, very low numbers of endemic species when climate change velocity is high. And the areas in the world where we see high concentrations of endemic species, those are almost exclusively areas where climate change velocity is very low.
So within these three groups, amphibians, birds, and mammals, how did they all react to climate change velocity?
That was one of the interesting things we found. We'd predicted ahead of time that the importance of climate change velocity would depend on the dispersal ability of the group. Because you can think about, again, as I said before, climate change velocity is the rate at which a species would have to move to keep up with climate change. And so if a species' dispersal ability doesn't let it keep up with that rate, then we expect possibly the species' range to shrink or possibly for the species to go extinct. So if you look at amphibians, mammals, and birds, our hypothesis going in was that amphibians, which are generally the weakest dispersers of the three, will respond most strongly to variation in velocity. And birds, which are strong dispersers, will have a relatively weak relationship with velocity. And in fact, that's what we found. Amphibians show a very strong dependence on low velocity sites, whereas birds, you sometimes find endemic bird species in even the high velocity unstable areas. And then the last thing we looked at along these lines was we took the mammals and we split them into bats and non-flying mammals, the idea being that bats might behave a little bit more like birds and the non-flying mammals might behave a little bit more like amphibians. And in fact, that's how it turned out. Bats respond less strongly to velocity than do the non-flying, more weakly dispersing mammals.
So to sum this all up a little bit, basically you're saying that where there's a higher change in climate, you have fewer small-range species and that amphibians are sort of the most sensitive to this relationship?
Yes, that's right.
So you mentioned this dispersal ability, which, you know, you emphasize as one of the main attributes, but are there any other attributes of these species that you think might be responsible for this relationship?
That's a really interesting question to me, and it's not something that we looked at in the paper, but I think there's a lot of interesting work to be done here. So I'd say that dispersal ability is the obvious one. It's the first one that came to mind, but you can imagine there might be a lot of other characteristics of species that would make them more or less vulnerable to climate instability. For example, body mass. Large-bodied species might, on average, be better dispersers, but on the other hand, they might also have, on average, smaller population sizes. And population size is a link to extinction risk, so I'm not sure which way to expect that one to go, but I think that will be a really interesting thing to look at. And then we've had a lot of other ideas, for example, diet or lifespan, clutch sizes in birds, litter sizes in mammals. And the nice thing is that the data exists. People have been putting together large databases for these groups.
So what is the overall significance of this work in terms of climate change or conservation, anything like that?
To me, at least, I think there are two major important aspects of the work. The first is that it really shows, I think, very strongly and clearly that historical climate fluctuations can still have a really strong imprint on modern patterns that we see. And that means that if you're trying to explain a modern pattern like variation and endemism, it's not enough simply to look at descriptions of modern climate. You also ideally should be taking into account the patterns of historical climate change. But I think there's also very important implications for thinking about anthropogenic climate change, because there have been major climate changes in the past, and the study shows that those major climate changes have had large consequences on vertebrate communities. And so as we embark on these upcoming decades of rapid climate change, we can expect, based on these kinds of results, that should continue to have major consequences on species. In particular, those consequences should be strongest for weakly dispersing species, as we found, for species with small range size. and also for species living in topographically flat regions where velocities tend to be highest. And another one of the interesting results that came out of the study is that if you compare climate change velocity since the last glacial maximum to the velocities we expect over the next century, overall we see a huge increase in expected velocities. And in general, there's a good correlation between past climate change velocity and future climate change velocity. So the same areas that have experienced high velocity in the past should also be experiencing high velocities in the future, on average. But there are some really interesting exceptions. And those exceptions are important because the areas that have been stable in the past and will experience high velocities in the future are the areas where we already have a bunch of endemic species and where those endemic species will be at the most risk in the future. And those areas, two of the most notable are the Amazon basin. Much of it will be experiencing much higher velocities than it ever has in the past, and actually a good portion of Africa as well. And both of those are areas where we find fairly high endemism for all three of the vertebrate groups. So I'd say those are conservation implications and concerns.
Well, Brody Sandel, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You can read the paper, The Influence of Late Quaternary Climate Change Velocity on Species Endemism, at www.scienceexpress.org.
The Crab Pulsar, a spinning neutron star in the Crab Nebula, is one of the most widely studied objects in astronomy. As it spins, acceleration zones rev up particles to near-light speeds, which in turn emit intense gamma radiation. A scientific collaboration this week reports the observation of pulsed gamma ray emissions from the Crab Pulsar at over 100 billion electron volts, an observation that challenges current pulsar models that don't predict such high energy radiation. The findings shed light on the enormous energy of the star, as well as on where and how the intense particle acceleration takes place. Corresponding author Nepomuk Otte spoke with me about the findings by mobile phone while traveling through the southwestern U.S.
We know that the Crab is the result of a supernova explosion that took off in 1054 and was observed all around the world, which must have been a really incredible event, which was seen in bright daylight for about 3 weeks after the supernova went off. When we look at the Crab now, we do not see this afterglow of the supernova anymore, but instead we see a very bright nebula, which it was not really understood where the energy comes from that powers that nebula. And it was only 50 years ago when in the center of this nebula there was a bright pulsar found, which we now call the Crab Pulsar. And I think the reason why the Crab is so heavily studied is because it's very close to Earth and it's a very, very bright source, which allows very detailed measurements of basically all wavelengths and with very high resolution, which gives us a very detailed picture of a cosmic particle accelerator.
Yeah, okay, so you were looking at this pulsar to actually get at some of these sort of particle acceleration issues, and your paper makes an observation that seems to kind of run counter to some of the standard models of how pulsars behave. Can you just talk a bit about, you know, before this paper, what those standard models were saying?
So let me here step back for a moment and briefly talk about what actually a pulsar is. We seem to understand pretty well what in principle a pulsar is. It's born when the progenitor star explodes and the core collapses into a compact and very fast spinning object. And then the object is really very compact. It just has a diameter of 10 miles, but is 1.5 times as heavy as our sun. And in case of the Crab pulsar, it rotates 30 times per second around its own axis, and it's really an incredible object. Now, what is co-rotating with this neutron star is a very strong magnetic dipole field. We call it the magnetosphere, in which huge electromotive forces are induced in a very similar way as an electric generator in a car or in a power plant, but the scales are much, much larger. Just to give you an idea of the dimension, the magnetosphere of a pulsar has a diameter that's of the order of 1,000 kilometers. So it's really, really very huge. And so in an electric generator, there's a current induced in the copper windings, but in the magnetosphere, there are huge voltages induced in which charged particles can accelerate to very high energies. But we do not know exactly where in the magnetosphere these locations are where the particles can accelerate. And this is where the models that we have on particle acceleration and pulses differ. It's basically the locations of these acceleration zones. And we have acceleration zones that are very close to the neutron stars, just above the poles, or acceleration zones that are very far out in the magnetosphere.
And so the location of those zones would make different predictions about the actual energy of the particles that were being sent out?
Yes, that is totally correct. So by observing gamma rays that comes from the magnetosphere of these pulsars, we can directly infer where in the magnetosphere the location zones are and what the characteristics are of the particles that are being accelerated.
Okay, and you looked at this particular pulsar with the Veritas Observatory. Can you just tell me exactly what Veritas is?
Veritas is an array of four Cherenkov telescopes located in South Arizona, and Veritas detects gamma rays with energies above 100 GeV. So 1 GeV is 1 billion electron volts, which is 1 billion times more energetic than the photon that comes from our sun.
Okay, so you were looking with an instrument that looks for energies at higher than 100 billion electron volts, but my understanding is the standard models of pulsars don't expect pulsed emissions at those energies. So sort of why point the instrument at this pulsar in the first place?
Yeah, this is a very good question, and this very same question I also got asked by my collaborators. But what was driving this observation was not so much the expectation, but more previous observations of the Krebs pulsar. And there are basically two observations that come into play here, and one is from the Fermilab detector, which is a gamma ray detector at energies from 100 MeV, 100 million electron volts, up to 20 giga electron volts. And the Fermilab detector has measured the gamma ray emission from the Krebs pulsar with very good precision, and it seems to indicate turnover at around 10 giga electron volts, which seemed to be very consistent with what people expected, how the energy spectrum should look like. But if you were more optimistic and asked yourself, is it also possible that with this data, there should be emission above 100 GeV? The answer was a clear yes. So it was by no means excluded that there should be gamma ray emission above 100 GeV, even though from the models we didn't expect that. In addition, the MAGIC team, which operates a different Cherenkov telescope, had two indications that the pulsar might radiate gamma rays with energies of at least 60 GeV. So because the possibility that the pulsar might radiate up to 100 gigaelectron volts wasn't really excluded by observations, but only by expectation, was the main motivation to look at the Krebs pulsar with Veritas in much more detail.
So you had these hints that there might be emissions at higher energies. What did Veritas actually find here?
Our main finding is that, in contrast to those expectations, the gamma emission does not turn off in a very steep cutoff, but extends to 100 gigaelectron volts and even goes as high as 400 gigaelectron volts, and maybe it even goes to 1,000 gigaelectron volts.
So these are potentially hugely higher energies than what was predicted.
Yes, these are much, much, much higher energies than had been previously thought can come from a pulsar.
And so we have this observation of these gamma ray pulses at much higher energies than expected. What would that require in terms of changing our views about how pulsars actually operate?
Yeah, with this observation, we now believe that the emission must come from much, much further out in the magnetosphere, almost at the point where the magnetosphere rotates with the speed of light, which is very little understood how the magnetosphere behaves in these distances. And furthermore, it's at the very edge of the magnetic dipole. So it's a very radical change in our picture on how we believe gamma ray emission comes from pulses. So what we have also learned is that gravitational radiation, which is an emission mechanism that was previously favored and results when these charged particles follow along the curved magnetic field lines, cannot account for the observed emission. Instead, what we now believe is that the gamma rays that are emitted in this gravitational radiation process are very efficiently converted into pairs of electrons and positrons, which in turn emit gamma rays up to 100 GeV or 400 GeV in a process that is called inverse Compton scattering. And what happens in inverse Compton scattering is that a low-energy photon encounters the electron and is upscattered to very high energies, to 100 gigaelectron volts and 400 gigaelectron volts. What might also be is that all these previous explanations are completely wrong, and the standard picture that we have of a pulsar, how gamma ray emission works in the pulsar, is completely wrong and needs to be completely revised. And one idea that has been put forward, and is a very radical one, is that the pulse emission actually does not come from within the magnetosphere, but from outside of the magnetosphere. And if this is true, this can definitely be falsified or verified with upcoming observations with Veritas.
Nepomuk Atta, thanks very much.
Thank you, Stuart.
Nepomuk Atta is an author on a study of the Crab Pulsar's gamma ray emissions, published in this week's Science.
There's no question that humans are leaving their mark on the planet. But some scientists argue that our imprint is distinctive and enduring enough to signal the start of a new geological epoch, which they suggest should be called the Anthropocene. In a news focus this week, writer Gaia Vince explores the heated debate surrounding this designation. She spoke with me about the story from London.
This feature actually describes the Anthropocene, which is this new term which a lot of people are using. But until now, it's not really been a specific geological term. It's not understood along the boundaries. And what it describes really is human system-wide impacts on the planet. So how people are changing the Earth in a way that up until now has mainly been done through huge geological things like volcanoes or asteroids or meteor impacts. And we're having these huge system-wide effects on things like climate, on sediment changes, on the acidity of the ocean, and lots of other measurable things. And so the idea of the Anthropocene is to acknowledge this on the geological timescales. So you will have heard of the Jurassic when the dinosaurs were around. And at the moment, we're in the Holocene, which is an epoch that's been going for the last 11,500 years. So this would be the Anthropocene, if it's agreed, and it would be the first time that humans have had such an influence on our planet that they've pushed it into a new recognizable timescale.
So why now? What has brought this debate to the forefront?
Well, so in a lot of the ways that we look at past changes, for example, extinction rates, biodiversity rates, we're now in a situation where we're mirroring some of these ancient effects. So at the moment, the extinction rate is up to 1,000 times the background rate, and that's because of us. Also, the amount of carbon dioxide dissolved into the oceans, which is making it more acidic. We've had more acidic oceans before, but not for, well, at least 800,000 years. We haven't seen levels like this. So it's the extreme change that's going on and the rapidity which is leading people to think that we're really living in a world which is very different from the Holocene norms.
So you've already mentioned extinction rates and ocean acidification. Are there any other arguments that scientists are proposing for this Anthropocene epoch?
So at the moment, the amount of rocky planetary material that we're moving through mining and other excavations is already four times what's moved naturally by glaciers and rivers. Also, we're changing the hydrology of the planet. So we're changing freshwater supplies. And more than half of freshwater is now under human management in some way, through reservoirs or through canals, artificial lakes. There are now more trees grown in agricultural zones than in forests. And the amount of energy we produce is likely to exceed that released by tectonic activity within 50 years. I mean, that's an enormous thing to say for one species. So we're changing the planet in chemical ways, in biological ways, and in lithographic ways, in terms of the topography of the Earth.
So I think an interesting variable here is that in order to make a designation on the geological record, we need to be seeing changes that will be significant on the geologic timescale. Which of these do scientists propose will actually be visible thousands or millions of years from now?
Well, some things are already laying themselves down, if you like, in the fossil record. For example, the carbon dioxide that we're putting in the atmosphere, most of that is coming from burning fossil fuels. And because plants slightly prefer one isotope of carbon over another of the two stable isotopes, you get a different balance of carbon isotope in the atmosphere. And that then, of course, is absorbed by corals and shell-building sea creatures. And the accretion of shells in the ocean layer will already show a carbon isotope difference, which is quite interesting. If you look at the way that we manage our biodiversity. So we've chosen a certain number of animals, like cows and goats and sheep, dogs, cats, and there's many, 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 many more of those animals, their wild cousins. And so looking clearly at the fossil records, we'll see a misbalance there. And we'll also see evidence of our mark on the planet in things like, for example, cities, especially the ones that are already sinking into the mud, those built on river deltas. They're much more likely to fossilize. And things like roads, according to the geologists I spoke to, the way that they will fossilize will be very interesting. So say there was a geologist working 10 million years from now, they might see the imprint of a road and it will look a little bit more regular than a river bed, and it might have some novel materials in there. And that's how they'll know that this is a road and it's not a river. And then there's the biggest one of all, I suppose, which will be easily recognizable and which we can record now, which is the radioactive signal that we've left in cesium isotopes and other metal isotopes since the first atomic tests that are going to be a signature of our existence, of our time on this planet.
Well, it sounds like there are ample arguments for this designation. What are some counterarguments?
So a lot of geologists think that our mark is not big enough on a geological timescale. I mean, we've been around as a species for not very long, and the extent of time that we've really made our mark on the planet, 10,000 years or so, is absolutely minuscule if you look at it on a 4.5 billion year timescale. It gives pause to think that, are we too enmeshed? Are we too focused in on our own perspective as a species? Are we able to go outside of this and look at the entire history of the world and say, yes, this is a strong mark, or no, it isn't? Most of the time, when geologists make these boundaries and define different eras or different epochs or different periods, they're doing it from a perspective of millions of years hence. They can look back and see that because it's a stripe in the rock. It's quite difficult and it's quite a conceptual challenge to do it when you're actually in the time period as it's happening. And one of the people I spoke to, Stan Finney, who's a geologist at California State University, he also brought up what I think is a pretty valid point, actually, which is, why are we doing this? It's completely irrelevant. The geological timescale is of relevance only for us now, looking back on things like dinosaurs when we weren't here. Nowadays, we've got videos, we've got film footage, we've got the internet, we've got so many ways of marking our time on this earth, and we can look back and find out when things happen in a much better way than digging through strata. I mean, he says the Anthropocene is a useful general term, but it's got no place on the official stratigraphic timescale.
And what really fascinates me about this discussion is that it's almost as much a philosophical debate as it is a scientific one.
It definitely is. We've already been geoengineering our planet up until now unknowingly, and now we're doing it knowingly. So that gives us an entirely different dimension and an entirely different philosophy on how to change this and whether or not we want to change it. So we're at this really exciting stage, I think.
So what's next? How are geologists going to officially decide yay or nay for the Anthropocene epoch?
So the working group still has plenty of investigations to do. They're still looking at what the signs of our presence on this planet are and which of these signals will last for millions of years, which ones will actually change the fossil record. And then they're going to make a decision on whether or not they think that the Anthropocene should be recognized as an official boundary, and then they will deliver their final report. They're aiming to do it at not the next International Geology Conference, which is next year, but the one after that, which is in 2016, and that's in South Africa. And then the geologists will mull it over and make some sort of decision, and that's going to take some time because these are slow-moving beasts. Geologists. They don't like to make any fast decisions, so we've got some time to find out. And meanwhile, I think that the rest of the scientific community outside of geologists will probably be taking the term on board anyway. I'm already hearing it used lots more.
Gaia Vince, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kerry.
Gaia Vince writes about the case for an Anthropocene epoch in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, Daniel Strain of Science's news department is here to fill us in on some recent stories from our daily news site. So, Dan, first, an interesting development in prosthetics.
Yeah, we actually have a case of virtual limbs that can actually feel. That's a pretty big deal. Despite advances in prosthetics recently, very few of them have been able to actually get sort of tactile sensation. Very important for picking up fragile objects like pencils or eggs.
So what exactly was done here to make that advance?
Well, what we have here is monkeys that are actually moving a limb on a computer screen. What the researchers did that was very innovative is they actually planted two sets of electrodes in the monkeys' brains. One they put in the center of the brain that controls motor ability, and in the other they put in the region of the brain that actually feels sensations. What happened is that the monkeys could actually control the movement of a limb on the computer screen using the electrode planted in the motor center. They reached out this limb trying to grab a disc. Some of these discs were rough, some of them were smooth, and once the limb contacted them, the other electrode, the one planted in the part of the brain that senses tactile information, actually started to buzz in a certain way, and it gave off a specific signal. For the discs that were actually smooth, the electrodes started to have a very sort of fast pulse, a pulse with a high frequency. For the discs that were more rough, they had a slower pulse, and that way they were sort of able to signal the monkey which particular sort of sensation they were feeling. With a little bit of training and a little bit of rewards, they actually taught the monkeys to sort of associate those pulses with the right sensation and actually were able to have, in essence, a monkey that could feel these virtual objects.
Well, how long does it take a monkey to actually learn how to do this?
Well, I mean, the researcher says that it's actually almost no time at all. That's sort of the interesting advancement. The researcher said that it was about minutes to actually associate this virtual limb with being its own limb. It's actually tricked into thinking that the limb on the computer screen is actually its own.
That's pretty amazing. So how long before we see this in humans?
The researchers say it will be quite a few times, and they do point out that tactile sensation isn't the only sort of sensation that's important for sort of a limb like this. Your hand also feels heat. It also feels its position in space, and they haven't yet been able to figure out how to create those sensations.
So still a very complex system to figure out.
Indeed, yeah.
And next, a rather tantalizing connection between warfare and climate.
Yeah, this is a very, as you say, tantalizing study where the authors actually argue that the root of a great deal of human conflict actually lies in climate change.
Well, how on earth could you make such a distinction? I mean, it seems like there'd be so many factors to consider, you know, why zero in on climate?
Well, that's an interesting question, and researchers have often been focusing on this at an anecdotal level. They've seen indications of historical societies that fell into sort of tumult during cases where the weather is severe. And the authors point out the case of in the 17th century, Europe turned extremely frigid, and at the same time, the powers engaged in the very lengthy 30-year war. Almost at the exact same time, Manchurian soldiers actually stormed the Great Wall of China as well. So to actually take those stories and see how exactly they fit the data, the researchers actually looked at the past between about 1500 and 1800. They examined a number of different sort of variables that they thought might cause conflict. Some of these were, like I said, climate change, but then other ones addressed issues such as human height and the price of gold, sort of more obscure items. Interestingly enough, when they sort of looked at the statistics, it seemed very obvious that humans actually seem to engage in warfare and other sort of violent clashes right around the periods that the world saw extreme cold spells or extreme warm spells, just like those really cold winters in Europe.
Have they any idea why climate change would cause this sort of effect?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question, and they do sort of have some suspicions, and they think it largely comes down to agriculture. Obviously, when the climate sort of shifts severely, you get big losses in agriculture. And it's important to point out that at this time, there was a situation of subsistence farming. So people very much depended on the weather in order to sustain themselves. And so what happens is when you get these severe climate shifts, you basically run out of food. That can lead to a number of different factors, including the spread of diseases. And the authors note that when people tend to be miserable, they also tend to to get very aggressive as
Interesting. Well, I understand this work is rather controversial.
Yeah, that's right. You know, a number of researchers sort of pointed out particular flaws in sort of the study. And one of the big ones that some folks noted was that it's only basically looking at historical data. There's not necessarily a good sense if the same sort of trends apply to the current era, especially since the agricultural system has changed quite a bit. So it's probably a bit premature to say that this is necessarily something that will affect us in the future with current climate change.
Well, that's a relief, given that the climate is changing. Finally, this week, in a nod to the Nobel Prize Awards, you have a review of the Ig Nobel Awards. Tell us about those.
Right. We've been hearing quite a bit about the Nobel Prizes, which are obviously very, very important advances and important awards. And we're turning to the Ig Nobels, which famously advertise that they first make you laugh and then make you think. So the Ig Nobel Committee has a very, very interesting spread this year. My particular favorite is the award for biology, which is actually a study that goes back quite a ways, but it's a study that looks at why certain species of Australian beetles preferentially mate with a distinct type of Australian beer bottle. And according to the analysis, it turns out that something about this particular type of beer bottle, the color, the shape of the bottle, some bumps along the edges, really, really attract this one particular species of beetle.
And I understand the medicine prize was rather interesting as well.
The medicine prize was actually a good one, and definitely does make you think. This prize looks at two different research teams. They're addressing how you make decisions on a full bladder, which is obviously something that we've all faced in our lives. And it actually can be a plus and a minus. So one of these studies looked at how having a full bladder affects your short-term memory. It actually turns out it's very, very bad for your short-term memory. Maybe you're only able to remember how uncomfortable you feel, but it's about equivalent to the losses of memory that you have after 24 hours of sleep deprivation. But the flip side of this is that some decision-making gets better when you have a full bladder. Researchers did this study where they offered participants $16 tomorrow or $35 in 35 days. So the question is, are people able to delay their gratification for a bigger reward? And while most people would just take these $16, people that really, really had to pee actually waited for the $35. Perhaps their sort of priorities were off.
I suppose those experiments must have been very interesting to conduct.
Right, and probably kind of uncomfortable for the subjects. Yeah.
Okay, Daniel, what other stories are you looking at for the news site?
Well, going from the Ig Nobels, we have quite a few stories about the Nobel Prizes that are awarded in physics, chemistry, and medicine, the real ones this time. We also have a new look at images coming in from the Dawn spacecraft investigating the asteroid Vesta. And in Science Insider, we look at a new report by scientists and policy analysts, which presses for the federal government to start engaging in geoengineering research. And finally, in our online chat, Science Live, we have a very fascinating discussion this week about something you talked about earlier in the podcast, which is the Anthropocene, the question of whether or not humans have changed the world so much that we're now entering into a new geologic era. So be sure to check out all of these stories and online discussions on our site.
Daniel Strain writes for the Science News Department. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the October 7th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Stuart Wills.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.